Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram for Thursday, February 25th. Endeavor CEO says recovery is faster than anyone anticipated. The story was written by Miller McEwen. After he was asked to deliver the Midland Chamber of Commerce's annual State of the Oil and Gas presentation last November, Lance Robertson reflected on the state of the industry at that time. At the time, prices were around $35, and Robertson, Chief Executive Officer of Endeavor Energy Resources, said if he had been asked about oil prices last summer, quote, "I would have hoped and prayed for a number with a 4 in front of it," end quote. As he was addressing a limited in-person crowd at the Barbara and George H.W. Bush Convention Center Wednesday, oil prices crossed the $63 barrier, their highest level since before the global COVID-19 pandemic began. Getting to the topic at hand, Robertson told those in person and watching his presentation online that, quote, "We are on the right track in recovering from an economic downturn unprecedented in its swiftness. In fact," he said, "recovery has occurred faster than anyone anticipated. Global oil demand is recovering the steep losses seen last year as economies shut down and people stayed home," he said, "which is helping eliminate the huge overhang of supply built up by the demand destruction. Driving that recovery is the demand for liquid fuels, gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel, which is still about 2 million barrels a day below pre-pandemic levels," he said. Also boosting the recovery is what Robertson called the remarkable support of members of the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries and allied nations in curtailing output, along with U.S. producers who shut in wells as oil prices plunged and have not yet put all of them back online. Robertson assured his audience that there will be growth, but the pace will be slower and steadier than in the past. U.S. producers are expected to keep production levels flat compared to the previous year, and what growth is seen in domestic output will be driven by the Permian Basin. The Permian Basin will lead for several reasons, he said, beginning with its low break-even costs, the lowest of any producing basin in the U.S. The region also competes in its abundance of resources and established takeaway infrastructure. Approximately two-thirds of the nation's drilling rigs are at work in the Permian, a ratio he expects to be maintained for the time being. What will limit growth in the Permian and elsewhere is the decline in producers' reinvestment in drilling, prompted by investors' demand to return cash to investors. Other possible hurdles include transportation issues caused by opposition to pipeline projects like the Dakota Access and the Keystone XL, whose permits were revoked by President Biden on his first day in office. The new Biden administration's focus on environmental issues could also serve as a hurdle, Robertson cautioned. Even given those concerns, Robertson said he expects the Permian Basin to remain vital and offered these reasons. Successful administration of COVID-19 vaccines is needed to drive economic recovery. Oil demand will recover steadily. Oil pricing is supported by demand recovery and continued industry restraint. U.S. production needs to stabilize. Permian energy resources and well inventory best situated to support future needs. Permian activity will continue to grow in 2021. Quote, "We need to continue investing in our community," he concluded. "Now is not the time to despair, but to be positive and keep moving forward," end quote. Most electric customers protected from sky-high energy bills. majority are on fixed-rate plans not susceptible to wholesale prices. The story was written by Mella McEwen. As if record-breaking cold, electricity blackouts, and burst water pipes are not headaches enough for Texans, some are now receiving astronomical energy bills in the wake of the recent cold front that blanketed Texas. Some are reporting receiving bills as high as $12,000, but experts say most electric customers need not fear such huge bills. Quote, "It's our understanding that the majority of retail electric customers are in fixed-rate plans," Andrew Barlow, Director, External Affairs at the Public Utility Commission of Texas, told a reporter Telegram by email. Quote, "The plans that are indexed to the wholesale rate likely comprise the bulk of the billing horror stories that have been emerging. While legal under PUC rules, the reports of the contract storm-related billing have drawn additional scrutiny from the PUC, which is exploring their compliance with rules on disclosures and more, and very likely the legislature," end quote. While the PUC cannot change electric contracts, he said it can enforce its rules. And to help Texans cope with the aftermath of the winter storm, the PUC has suspended disconnections for non-payment until further notice and ordered utilities not to process disconnections. The PUC is also continuing the COVID-19 measure under which retail electric providers are required to offer deferred payment plans to customers when requested. Atmos Energy, which provides natural gas to Midland customers, issued a statement assuring customers near-term bills will not include any of the unusually high gas prices seen during the historic winter storm. The company said it is working with regulators on ways to minimize the impact on monthly bills, and until those solutions are found, the gas cost portion of a customer's bill will reflect normal seasonal gas prices. Atmos cautioned that February and March bills may still be higher than in recent months based on the amount of gas used during the winter storm. It is offering installment plans to spread out payments over time with no additional charges or fees. There are federal programs being established to help Texans struggling to pay their electric bills. There is also the established Low-Income Home Energy Assistance Program and programs operated by various energy providers. Scott Nethery, president of Energy Ogre, the technology company that helps consumers find the lowest cost electric plan that fits their usage profile, told a reporter Telegram by telephone that those in variable rate plans were likely either playing the market or did not have a contract. While his company is not privy to the finances of the state's various retail electric providers, Nethery said some will likely be financially impacted by the storm. Mike England, Vice President, Business Development at Energy Ogre, said the winter storm and resulting high bills underscored the need for Texans to research the state's electricity markets and find the lowest cost providers. Local photographer creates online confidence courses for women. The story was written by J.C. Lewis. A local photographer has created online confidence courses for women. When Jaslyn Cuellu moved to Midland, she brought her photography business, but when the pandemic hit, she knew she needed to expand her business while continuing to help women. Her mission with photography has always been to instill confidence in women. Quote, "I feel like with COVID, it made me realize what my audience was looking for," she said. "Photography is definitely a luxury thing, and for people to budget for this expense, it really has to be worth their while. It got me thinking about why people book my services," end quote. She realized that clients who continued to come back to her business benefited from working with her to feel comfortable and beautiful in front of a camera. She decided to pivot part of her business so it didn't rely as much on in-person meetings or face-to-face services for those uncomfortable with that during a pandemic. She started to build her business, Confident You, and its website, confidentuniversity.teachable.com, which launched in February. The website will offer one-on-one coaching via Zoom, online courses, and will also set up a community for women with the future potential of holding local meetups and retreats. Quote, "One of the very first lessons I'm covering during the program's freshman year is mindset, because I believe mindset changes the game for everything else," she said. "I think you have to be at one with yourself in order to move forward, especially when it comes to self-image and confidence," end quote. Later on during the courses, participants will learn skills to help with relationships, such as setting boundaries and being able to assert themselves in a professional setting, she said. Kuei-Yu is a certified life coach, but she said she feels like building confidence has been her life's work. Quote, "It feels like being confident has been my life's work," she said. "I have always been an outgoing person. I have always been very social around people. I did experience a lot of bullying growing up. I've always been on the heavier side with my weight, and it's just something that really traumatized me," end quote. She said after being bullied, she had to rediscover her confidence. Quote, "I had to climb my way back to being confident," she said. "But then, when I had my children, I had to rediscover what confidence was from a mom point of view, because my body changed and my freedom changed. I had to get to know myself again and who I was postpartum, which I think a lot of women have to go through," end quote. Kuei-Yu has also had experience confidence coaching her friends. In her photography business, she learned how to help women feel comfortable in front of a camera, something she learned a lot about from her mentor. She has continued her photography business with mostly outdoor photo sessions. Quote, "I really want people to know that everyone struggles with self-image and self-esteem, especially when there's a lot of things going on outside of their control," she said. Quote, "I want people to know it's not something that you're either born with or without confidence. Instead, they can train, educate, and practice confidence. It's a skill, but it doesn't happen overnight," end quote. Potential participants can sign up for one-on-one sessions at confidentuniversity.teachable.com, and the full confidence course is launching on June 27th. She has put together interactive quizzes and worksheets. Now she is working on recording videos and editing. A focus group will go through the 8-week course before the launch as well, she said. Quote, "There will be one-on-one coaching where I walk participants through this curriculum and fill out quizzes and worksheets, but those aren't graded," she said. "It is to help with retention of information. Participants can go as fast or as slow as they like," end quote. There will be a paced option for 8 weeks, she said. Each module has a pair of 2-week semesters. Then participants will have a one-on-one session with Kuei-Yu after each module, resulting in 4 one-on-ones. She said people looking for accountability in the program should sign up for the paced option. Her target audience is 24 to 34-year-olds. Quote, "I'm considering putting out other courses for specific niches such as moms and teenagers," she said. "I feel like when my hardest times were when I was a teenager and after having children," end quote. The program will also have specific things for Midland participants, she said. There will be Confident You ambassadors, who also will talk about their own experiences. The ambassadors come from different races, ages, and backgrounds. Some are entrepreneurs, and others work within the corporate realm. Quote, "Our focus group also came up with the idea of having meetups, kind of like college sororities, she said. There will be real opportunity for a community made up of women who went through the course or are currently going through the course, end quote. Once participants sign up, they will be added to a Facebook group to start making connections with others. She said she is excited for the meetups and creating connections with more Midland women, end quote.
Hello, this is Michael, reading additional articles from the inside of the Midland Reporter-Telegram, published Thursday, February 25th. Area Briefs from Staff Reports. Midland Health Vaccine Distribution Closes in on 40,000. Midland Health should top 40,000 vaccine administrations sometime this week. The organization reported on Wednesday that it averaged 1,895 on Monday and Tuesday. At that pace, the 40,000 mark should be reached no later than Thursday. Midland Health reported 37,720 through Tuesday. The Horseshoe is the place where the most vaccines have taken place, 16,834 through Tuesday. That total included 2,251 this week. There have been 3,305 vaccines administered at Golf Course Church of Christ, including 1,380 this week. Midland Health also stated this week that officials are expected to go out into the area again this week and next, including returns to Garden City Wednesday and Fort Davis and Marfa next week. Midland Health CEO Russell Myers said Tuesday that doses also are being distributed to officials in communities that can handle their own administration, like Martin County and Big Bend Regional. Transfers accounted for 3,600 doses in January, according to Midland Health's Vaccination Administration report. Midland Health reported 8,715 vaccines had been administered in the last 5 days that they were administered through Tuesday. Two died in I-20 crash near Monahans. Two people are dead following a crash Tuesday on Interstate 20 near Monahans that involved a driver going in the wrong direction. The Department of Public Safety reported Wednesday that Jerry D. Roberts, 81, of Monahans, was traveling west in an eastbound lane of the interstate around 7:15 p.m. It was Roberts' 2012 Jeep Nitro that collided with a 2017 Honda Accord being driven by Carlos A. Palma, 45, of Roswell, New Mexico. Both drivers died at the scene. There were two other vehicles involved in the incident, according to DPS. One driver evaded the collision but rolled his vehicle. The other struck debris in the roadway. Collision northwest of Andrews kills Hobbs man. An Odessa man turned without the right-of-way and collided with another vehicle, killing the driver early Tuesday morning in an incident 11 miles northwest of Andrews, according to the Department of Public Safety. William K. Wood, 42, of Hobbs, New Mexico, was driving his 2017 Honda east on Farm to Market Road, 1967, when his vehicle was struck by a pickup towing a trailer. Rafael V. Tavares, 45, of Odessa, was driving the 2018 Dodge that was traveling west but failed to yield the right-of-way when turning south onto County Road 4401. Wood died at a medical center in Andrews. Texas Shakespeare Festival Roadshow Films at Globe Theater by J.C. Lewis. Odessa Arts, Odessa College, Basin PBS, and the Texas Shakespeare Festival have partnered to film two Shakespeare plays, Hamlet and Much Ado About Nothing, at the Globe Theater at Odessa College. These filmed performances will be broadcast on Basin PBS in honor of Shakespeare's birthday on April 23rd, according to a press release from Odessa Arts. Odessa Shakespeare Festival was scheduled in Odessa for November 2020, but was canceled due to the pandemic. Odessa Arts and the Texas Shakespeare Festival have been working together for the past 5 years, building an audience. Matthew Simpson, Associate Artistic Director of TSF, began crafting a plan to cast and rehearse the production in TFF's home in Kilgore. The cast would rehearse for 3 weeks while observing strict quarantine rules and maintaining social distancing, wearing masks, and sanitizing. The cast was tested once a week while in Kilgore as well. The cast and crew arrived in Odessa on February 21st and were tested one more time. After 2 days of rehearsal in the space, Overton Films arrived to capture the performances on film. The shooting schedule will keep the cast and crew in Odessa through February 26th. Upon completion, Overton Films will edit the footage, and then it will be broadcast on Basin PBS. In addition, digital copies of the film will be made available for classroom use to any school that requests them. To obtain a copy, contact Odessa Arts. Wagner Noel opens building for photos, plus upcoming acts about to take the stage, by J.C. Lewis. Starting today, Thursday, the venue is opening its doors for hour-long photo sessions that can be used for high school and college seniors, updating headshots, or to practice photography skills, according to a press release. Groups can sign up for 1 hour of time today, Friday, or Saturday. Groups of three pay $50 to reserve an hour time slot with access to the inside and outside of the building. The social event styling service, POPSI, POPSI, will construct two balloon backdrops on the stage with a UTPB-themed backdrop and a general class of 2021 backdrop. Guests can use their cell phones, professional cameras, or even a professional photographer to take photos. The Wagner Noel Performing Arts Center will not be providing professional photographers. If a group employs a professional photographer, he or she would count as part of the group of three. Coming soon, the Midland Odessa Symphony and Chorale will perform Sinatra and Beyond at 7:30 p.m. on March 6th. Tickets are $30 to $50, with student tickets being $17. Live on Stage presents Atlantic City Boys, which has been rescheduled to March 23rd. Comedian Brian Regan, who has the Nunchucks and Flamethrowers Netflix special, will perform at 7:30 p.m. on March 25th. Tickets are $42.50 to $65. Casting Crowns is performing a drive-in concert at 7 p.m. March 26th. Tickets are $115 to $325 per vehicle for up to six people. To purchase tickets, visit WagnerNoel.com. Resigning ERCOT board members acknowledge pain and suffering from extreme power grid strain, by Aaron Douglas, Texas Tribune. In the Electric Reliability Council of Texas's first meeting since a historic winter storm caused the near collapse of Texas's power grid, the director of the board acknowledged the pain and suffering that millions of Texans experienced during prolonged power outages, then resigned, along with five other board members. Leaders of ERCOT on Wednesday briefed the board on why millions of Texans sustained days-long power outages last week and apologized for not giving the board and the public earlier warning about the possibility of massive disruptions. The crisis last week and resulting criticism of ERCOT ended with the six board members' resignations, effective at the end of the meeting Wednesday. A seventh person, a board candidate, withdrew his application. "I want to acknowledge the pain and suffering of Texans during this tragedy that continues for many," said Sally Talberg, ERCOT's board chair, who was among the members who resigned. "All of our hearts go out to all of you who have had to go without electricity, heat, water, medicine, and food from frigid temperatures and continue to face the tragic consequences." Bill Magnus, president and CEO of ERCOT, told board members that nearly half of the power typically available to to Texas's grid went offline at the lowest point last week. The most significant source of power loss during the crisis came from natural gas power plants that couldn't generate power, whether from fuel supply shortages or freezing components at the plants. The grid that covers most of Texas lost an extraordinary amount of power, about 52,000 megawatts, Magnus said. That's enough to power more than 10 million Texas homes at peak demand. The loss stayed near those extreme levels for days due to power plants' inability to restart as temperatures remained below freezing in large swaths of Texas, making what should have been short rotating outages into a days-long crisis. In other events, when we've had rotating outages, like in 2011, the ability of generation to come back didn't take nearly as long, he said. The amount of demand on the grid could have climbed to more than 70,000 megawatts on February 15th if outages had not been implemented, ERCOT estimates. But that day, supply fell rapidly to fewer than 50,000 megawatts. It's imperative to keep the electrical grid balanced. Otherwise, Texas could have risked uncontrolled blackouts that may have lasted weeks, if not months, officials said. Because the amount of generation loss was so great, transmission companies, including CenterPoint Energy, which transmits power to much of the Houston region, and Oncor Electric Delivery, which transmits power to much of the Dallas and Austin regions, were unable to effectively rotate the controlled outages from customer to customer while maintaining service to critical infrastructure such as hospitals. That is one of the main problems during the crisis that ERCOT leaders said they will begin to address. The amounts of power to shed from the system required were so large that they could not move them, Magnus said. That's where so much of the harm came from. That is what we have to figure out. All forms of energy, natural gas, wind, coal, and nuclear plants, experienced outages last week. Natural gas generation was particularly challenged, data shows. Outages from natural gas plants spiked from around 11,000 megawatts to near 25,000 megawatts in the early hours of February 15th. The inability of gas-fired power plants to get enough fuel was also a much more severe problem last week than during the 2011 storm, according to ERCOT's data. If you don't have natural gas fuel, you can't run a natural gas plant, Magnus said. We saw a lot of fuel issues in the system. During the board meeting, members asked how the organization could have been better prepared and criticized ERCOT leaders for not effectively communicating to the public or the board further in advance just how extreme the crisis could become. Magnus apologized to the board for not giving the public and the board in-depth information about storm preparations or potential seriousness of the storm's consequences ahead of the crisis. Midland Reporter Telegram opinion page, Thursday, February 25th, 2021. Guest view. Reforming ERCOT. Here's one good idea and one bad idea. Among the reforms to be put forward in the aftermath of last week's storm, two seem most likely. Both have to do with preparing the system for severe weather. One is a good idea, the other is not. The good idea is to add teeth to the Electric Reliability Council of Texas. Right now, ERCOT can only suggest best practices for winterizing generating plants based on standards set by the North American Electric Reliability Corporation. Dan Woodfin, ERCOT's Senior Director of System Operations, said that its guidance is not really inspection, more like kindly suggestions. ERCOT does about 100 winterization spot checks per year out of about 600 generating plants in Texas. In preparation for this winter, ERCOT conducted 94 checks, all of them virtual because of the pandemic, Woodfin said. When the storm hit, 185 generators went offline. We don't yet know how many of those were among the 94 spot checked. One of the generators that tripped was a nuclear plant near Matagorda. One of two units there ceased production when water pumps froze. Officials at the plant said ERCOT did not perform a spot check of their system, but that the plant follows a prescriptive seasonal readiness checklist process that is consistent with industry best practices. Winterizing is more complicated than just wrapping pipes. Woodfin pointed out that northern states are able to operate in severe cold because generators there often build plants indoors. But an indoor plant can't produce as much power in the summer because it heats up too fast. Since summer is when Texas usually sees peak demand, companies build facilities outdoors. Even if they aren't spot checked, generators are required to attest that they have winterized, though the specific standards are not clear. This winter, one generator failed to provide that attestation. Tokai Carbon CB Limited of Fort Worth. 42 others did so late or improperly. Without turning ERCOT into a regulatory albatross, we think there's room to allow the agency to assess proportionate penalties against generators who don't meet weatherizing standards. Now for the bad idea. One proposed reform would allow generators to pass along their financial risk to their customers. In some states, power companies are allowed to add a resiliency charge to recapture costs incurred by a weather event. In Texas, a generator's customers are electricity wholesalers who would, undoubtedly, pass along such a fee to consumers. That won't fit with our deregulated system. At any given time, a portion of Texas's generating plants are left idle because there isn't enough demand for power. When weather knocks one generator offline, that drives up demand, so plants that were scheduled to be offline are incentivized to produce energy they can sell at higher prices. ERCOT CEO Bill Magnus said that happened last week. It should be noted, however, that this isn't as easy as flipping a switch. Ramping up operations can take anywhere from several hours to several days. A second free market lever is a law that requires those plants that go offline to pay for the energy they failed to produce. And since prices are inflated by such a failure, generators face big losses. A free market system must rely on financial incentives. The resiliency charge removes them. Fines for noncompliance add them. We hope the legislative review sorts proposed reforms appropriately. Opinion column by the Dallas Morning News. Winter storm response should focus on public safety, not dollars. Analysis by Ross Ramsey, Texas Tribune. While you're watching the taxpayer-funded spanking line on last week's freeze and blackouts, don't lose sight of the real losses behind the outrage. Prices of electricity and natural gas are getting a lot of attention. So are operational and design mistakes that left so many Texans without power and water during an unusually strong, lengthy, and widespread winter storm. But the storm and the failures of the state's infrastructure killed people who would not otherwise have died. This isn't solely or mainly about economics or energy. We're having a conversation about life and death, and about what we're willing to do to protect people in Texas from the elements. Not about a mere interruption in our daily lives. When utilities and energy are under consideration, Texas government focuses on economics, moving the pieces on the board with incentives and fines, rewarding one thing and resisting another. The arguments come with price tags, like they did when the legislature was responding to a February 2011 freeze with rolling blackouts. Protecting the pieces of the state's electrical grid from winter weather, winterization in industry parlance, was the recommendation at the time, as it is now. But the industries lined up against requiring winterproofing are strong, from natural gas producers to electric generators, transmitters, and distributors, to some of the biggest commercial and industrial electric users. Some wanted low electric rates, some wanted higher profits, and the state's writers of policy and law decided to err on the side of low prices instead of on the side of reliability. But after last week, you know that. The political repercussions are just beginning. Five members of the board of the state's grid operator, ERCOT, are resigning, and another, who was supposed to join the board, withdrew. The governor has made the CEO of that organization, Bill Magnus, the central scapegoat after blackouts last week left more than 4.5 million Texas households without power and up to 14 million households having to boil the water from their taps to make it safe enough to drink. The State House and the Senate will hold hearings tomorrow, beginning the postmortem that might result in some changes to keep last week from happening again. The governor has this on his list of emergency legislation. The lieutenant governor has this on his list of priority legislation twice. A lot of attention and talk has been about spikes in natural gas and electric prices, which under the current state law can legally reach exorbitant levels. And last week, they did. Estimates of the cumulative damage are in the same ballpark as the costs after major storms like Hurricane Harvey. The attorney general cautioned some businesses against price gouging during the blackouts, an admonition that doesn't include exorbitant jumps in spot prices for wholesale natural gas. It's possible lawmakers will put some precautions in place that were considered and discarded a decade ago. The debate that started with a polar vortex, blackouts, water cutoffs, and isolation imposed by dangerous icy roads has turned to matters of law and finance, to the language of cost-benefit analysis and political calculation. That's what happened last time, too. The real toll skips all of that. All of the busy plumbers and contractors fixing pipes and buildings, repairing damage done by the storm. For lack of heat and water, people died last week in the great state of Texas and in their own homes, who would be alive right now had the state taken heed of recommendations made after past storms and electrical blackouts. The counting is still underway, but the dead include an 11-year-old boy in Conroe, a San Antonio dialysis patient who left for his appointment but apparently died from exposure to the cold, a 60-year-old found in his house in Abilene, and two members of a Houston family asphyxiated in the idling car where they had gone to get warm. Those are the real losses, the human victims of a compound array of avoidable decisions and mistakes that left the state helpless in the face of a winter storm. It was a tragedy, and not because of the property and commercial damage. Dollars and personalities, business and regulatory priorities are important parts of the conversation and are often the preoccupation of Texas lawmakers at moments like this one. But it's possible to solve all of those problems without protecting Texans' lives, and that would be another tragedy.
Here are some obituaries that appeared in the Midland Reporter-Telegram on Thursday, February 25th. Sarah Von Sile Warren passed from this life on Sunday morning, February 14th, at Legacy Ranch in Midland, Texas, where she resided for the last few years of her life. She turned 94 in January, preceded in death by her husband of 58 years, Jake Warren, and her daughter, Lou Ann Warren. And she is survived by her son, Jay Warren, and wife Mindy of Midland, daughter, Candy Belsick, and husband Eddie Belsick of Fredericksburg, grandsons Waylon Warren of Midland, Clay Tarter of Llano, Kyle Tarter of College Station, and Jaden Warren of Midland, and one great-grandson. Von Sile, who is also lovingly known as Nonnie, Fonny, or Aunt Bonnie, was born in Comanche, Texas, to Charlie and Myrtle Carnes. She had one brother, Kenneth Carnes, and a sister, Merle McKee, who also preceded her in death over two decades ago. Services are under the care of Ellis Funeral Home in Midland. Officiating minister will be Pamela Vanoy, and pallbearers will be Vani's grandsons. Visitation will be held on Thursday, February 25th, from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. at Ellis Funeral Home in Midland. A graveside service will be held on Friday, February 26th at 1 p.m. at the Fluvanna Cemetery in Fluvanna, Texas. Eloisa Flores passed away on February 14th. She passed away at a residence in Midland. Eloisa was born in Ozona, Texas, to Ramon and Esther Valdez, and was the fourth of five children. She was preceded in death by Jose Flores, Ramon Valdez, her father, Esther A. Valdez, her mother, Jaime A. Ramirez Sr., a brother, and Jonathan Juan Flores, a great-grandson. Survivors include daughters Naomi Sanchez, Joyce Flores Reyes, and husband Jesse Reyes of Midland, and son Armando Flores and wife Gloria Flores of Las Vegas, Nevada. Sisters Esperanza Flores of Raleigh, North Carolina, Rosa Garcia, Margaret Shannon, and sister-in-law Edna Ramirez of Odessa. She's also survived by several grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and great-great-grandchildren. Visitation will be held on Thursday, February 25th from 10 a.m. to 9 p.m. with prayer service to be held at Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin at 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. with Reverend Manuel Hernandez of Templo Jerusalem. The funeral service will be held on Friday, February 26th at 10 a.m. at Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Chapel, and burial will follow at Fairview Cemetery with Pastor Johnny Paredes of Faith Foundation International Church officiating. Funeral service is under the direction of Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home and Chapel. Family messages and condolences may be emailed to Pipkin at ntsonline.net, or you can visit the website at www.LlewellynGarciaPipkinFH.com. Joan Cox of Midland, age 85, passed away on Monday, the 22nd day of February, after a sudden illness. Joan was born on December 6, 1935, in the town of Spur in Dickens County, Texas, to W.O. and Mamie Goodwin Finley. After graduating from high school, Joan married Bobby Lee Cox in 1953 in Fort Worth, and they were husband and wife for over 67 years. Joan is survived by her devoted husband, Bobby Joe Cox, her children, Bliss McCall, and husband J.O. Blake and his wife, Donna, and April Howard and her husband, Les, as well as several grandchildren and great-grandchildren. She is predeceased by her parents, two sisters, and brothers, and by her grandson. The family will receive guests from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. Friday, February 26th, at Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home in Midland. A private graveside service will be held at Rest Haven Cemetery in Midland. Her memorial service will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday, February 27th, at Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home Chapel at 3800 North Bixbridge Street in Midland. The family requests attendees to please wear a mask in honor of Joan. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences can be made at www.npwelch.com. Ladois K. Freeman, age 89 of Midland, a retired teacher and known to many as Granny Joyce, died Tuesday, February 23rd. Services will be at First Baptist Church of Midland on Saturday, February 27th at 2 p.m., with Reverend Curtis Brewer officiating. Joyce was born in Chickasaw, Oklahoma, to Thomas and Isola Kendrick on December 21st, 1931. She graduated from Chickasaw High School as the salutatorian in 1949. Joyce taught school for 35 years before retiring in 1989 from the Odessa, Texas Independent School District. Joyce was preceded in death by her husband, Lloyd O. Freeman. She is survived by sons, Carl Freeman and wife Patty, Craig Freeman and wife Linda, as well as several grandchildren and great-grandchildren. Memorial donations may be made to First Baptist Church of Midland at 2104 West Louisiana Avenue in Midland. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. A memorial service for Mary Alice Hoag is planned for Friday, February 26th at 2 p.m. at First Baptist Church in Midland. Mary Alice passed away on January 4th peacefully at home of natural causes. She was 97 years old. Mary Alice was born on July 25th, 1923, in rural Smith County, Texas, near Tyler. She was born in the same house as was her mother and oldest brother, Clark Hitt Jr., the home of her maternal grandparents. Her parents were Reverend Clark O. Hitt and Anna Mary Shank Hitt. Mary Alice was the oldest child and the only daughter out of six children. The children were sometimes referred to as Five Hits and a Miss. The Lord gave Cliff and Mary Alice three wonderful children, all born in Midland, Cliff Hoag Jr., Ben Paul Hoag, and Carol Jan Hoag Williams. They have five grandchildren, five step-grandchildren, 16 great-grandchildren, one adopted great-grandchild, and 15 step-grandchildren. No viewing or cemetery service. Cliff and Mary Alice willed their bodies to Texas Tech Medical School to help advance medical science. In lieu of flowers, the family requests donations be made to Living Hope Church at 740 Bramwell Street in Green River, Wyoming, 82935. Toral Devoy Crisp, age 51 of Midland, passed away on February 14th. He was born in Los Angeles, California on November 27, 1969, to Herbert and Betty Crisp. Torval worked as a warehouse manager for many years, but his most important job in life was being a wonderful, committed father, a loving son, and lifelong friend to his siblings. Left to cherish his memory is his wife, Deborah Powell of Midland, parents, Herbert and Betty Crisp of Midland, grandmother, Carrie Simon of San Angelo, grandfather, Johnny O'Neill of Odessa, daughter, Kayla Marie Crisp of Midland, sons, Cameron Ethan Crisp, Christian Miles Crisp, both of Midland, sister, Shakisha Ganey of Midland, Lachette Crisp of Midland, Latunda Bidushi, a brother, Herbert Lee Crisp Jr. of Midland, a special nephew, Isaiah Crisp of Midland, as well as a host of nieces and nephews. Visitation will be held Friday, February 26th from 9 a.m. until 8 p.m., with the family receiving friends from 5 p.m. until 8 p.m. at Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home Chapel, 1502 North La Mesa Road. There will be a break every 3 hours for sanitizing the chapel, and everyone is asked to please wear a mask in keeping with the COVID-19 safety precautions. A funeral service will be held Saturday, February 27th at 11 a.m. at Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home Chapel. Arrangements have been entrusted to Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home. William A. Heck, generally known as Bill to his friends and Pa to his family, passed away peacefully on February 18th. At age 97, he had a full and joyful life and was fortunate enough to pass the door of darkness through mistaking the approach of death for the return of health. A geologist, Bill learned his profession well. When asked about his achievements, he said that no elucidation would be necessary for those who knew him as to his successes and failings. And to those who knew him not, his career would be unimportant. He considered his greatest accomplishments to be his marriage to Katie, his wife of nearly 69 years, and his legacy to the world, his fine children and their families. Daughter Lyndon Teresa Heck Howell, deceased in 1999, and her husband J. William Howell, sons James Atkinson Heck and wife Kathy, and their three daughters Ellen Heck and husband Andreas Galasanka and son Marty, Juliana Heck Larson and husband Anton and son Beau, and Margaret Heck, son Douglas Guy Heck and wife Claire, and their son William Adam Heck II and daughter Sarah Heck. Katie and Bill married in 1952 in Midland, where they helped to build the growing community through participation in government and the arts. Bill was an elected county commissioner and Katie an elected city council member. For years, the couple was active in the Midland Community Theater. Should friends desire, contributions may be made to Midland Community Theater or Summer Mummers. Margaret Ramirez, age 89, of Midland, passed away on Monday, February 22nd. Viewing will be held on Thursday, March 4th, from 10 a.m. to 9 p.m., and Friday, March 5th, from 10 a.m. to 9 p.m. at Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home Chapel. The family will hold a rosary that evening at the family's residence. She is survived by one son, Juan Francisco Sines, one daughter, Mary Elena Castrelon, seven grandchildren, eight great-grandchildren, and numerous nieces and nephews. Susie Molina passed away on February 8th. A funeral mass will be held at St. Stephen's Catholic Church, Friday, February 26th at 11 a.m., with interment immediately following. Survivors include her father, Carlos Molina of Midland, and her son Caleb of Midland, and grandmother Soledad Castaneda of Denver, Colorado. Funeral services have been entrusted to Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home.
Hello, this is Cindy reading the Odessa American for Thursday, February 25th. City Council expands ODC by Federico Martinez. The Odessa City Council on Tuesday voted 5-2 to expand the Odessa Development Corporation Board from 5 to 7 members. The change gives Mayor Javier Hovan and at-large Councilwoman Denise Swanner each the power to now appoint their own choices to the influential ODC board. Previously, only council members representing districts 1 to 5 had the authority to each appoint one member to the board. Councilman Mark Mata, who made the motion to expand the ODC board, said he was proposing the plan because, "I want to see representation of the expanded council on ODC." Hovan, Mata, and Councilman Tom Sprawls pointed out that council previously wanted to expand the ODC board in 2018. The council didn't proceed because the city's attorney at the time told them that legally they were not allowed. "Our city attorney at the time misrepresented the law," Sprawls said. Current city attorney Natasha Brooks agreed with Sprawls and told council legally they could make the change. The city's bylaws state the ODC must have a minimum of 5 members, but not limit the membership number. Hovan and council members Mary Willis, Mata, Sprawls, and Swanner voted to expand the ODC to 6 members. Council members Steve Thompson and Deborah White voted against. Prior to the vote, White publicly questioned Hovan's motives for endorsing the change. "I strongly endorse the ODC," White said. "They are doing dynamic things. But, Mayor, I haven't spoken to you about any issues or concerns you might have." Hovan replied, "No, I have no issues or concerns. This was an issue that was discussed previously by council in 2018. I believe voters want their boards and committees to be reflective of council." Willis initially expressed concerns about adding new members to the ODC. She cautioned that new members added to the board need to have strong knowledge of business development. "We need to be careful," Willis said. "We have a lot of things going on in the city, things that need to be finished." Hovan and Swanner on Tuesday did not announce their choices to join the ODC. Council did approve other citizen appointments to various city boards and committees, an exercise council does annually. The ODC provides job creation grants, capital investment grants, and other incentives for businesses seeking to expand in Odessa. The The group also promotes and develops industrial and manufacturing enterprises in order to eliminate unemployment and bring new jobs. Council on Tuesday unanimously approved a $52,000 donation from the Chuck Wagon Community Fund, Inc., to the Odessa Police Department. The grant will be used to pay for police training, Police Chief Mike Gerke said. Speaker touts conservatism and diversity in Texas. By Michael Bauer. The Ector County Republic women were able to have their February luncheon on Wednesday at the Marriott Hotel and Convention Center after having to postpone last week due to the winter storm. ECRW President Rachel Miner was glad to be able to have this month's luncheon, even if it was a week behind schedule. Everything last week was too chaotic, Miner said. The flights weren't coming in. It was exciting to have everyone here today. The guest speaker was Claver T. Kamau Imani, who's a political activist from Beaumont. It was the first time for him to be in West Texas in nearly 10 years. It's great to be back in the Permian Basin, Kamau Imani said. There are good people out here and good land. It's been about a decade since I've been out here in this political atmosphere. Very few things have changed. It's a great community out here and a great experience. The hospitality is great. More people need to come out here. The closeness of the community is great. The Permian Basin is a great piece of real estate in God's creation. Kamau Imani is a self-described ultra-conservative and the founder, president, and CEO of Raging Elephants Radio, LLC, a digital media company that focuses primarily on Texas political, economic, and cultural news. He also ran for Texas House of Representatives in District 138 in 2020, but lost in the primary, receiving only 8.4% of the vote, losing to Lacey Hull. Kamau Imani said he wants to grow Republican Party through diversity. The first thing people should know is that the policies and positions that the Republican Party advocates really help everyone, regardless of age, gender, skin, Kamau Imani said. Our policies are really more or are designed for a diverse population, a diverse electorate. We believe the proof of our policies have shown that. Let's just take a look at Trump's term in office. We saw unemployment drop for people of color and for women. Kamau Imani was one of the millions of Texans who lost power in last week's winter storm. Let me put it to you this way. My family and I suffered more under the freeze than we did during Hurricane Harvey, Kamau Imani said. During Harvey, we lost no power, lost no internet or cable. That wasn't the case last week. It was a hard time. I had to send my family away. I stayed home to make sure the house was okay and that the pipes didn't break. There were other people in my neighborhood who weren't so lucky. Issues with the Texas power grid last week have divided some people in the state. However, Kamau Imani was adamant that the state continue having its own power grid. We may have problems with our power grid, but I would rather freeze to death than live under the tyranny of Washington, D.C., Kamau Imani said. According to the Associated Press, nearly 80 people have died as a result of the storm and its effects. Afterwards, Kamau Imani said that it was good to reconnect with old friends in the area. It's so gratifying to see them after so many years. The hospitality has been beyond my expectations. It's a reflection of the good people here in the Permian Basin. You guys have a lot to be proud of. Miner said they were happy to have Kamau Imani speak on Wednesday. We're excited to have all of our guest speakers. Claver has a unique experience and passion for Texas and God's Word and for the Texas people to return to the ways of the Lord, Miner said. The next ECRW luncheon is scheduled for March 17th, where the guest speaker is going to be Texas Director of Gun Owners of America, Rachel Malone.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.